Hey, good evening, Truth Seekers. Mike Malloy here on Nova M Radio. Yeah, we're back. Thanks for tuning in tonight. I don't know what to say about the technical difficulties we had Friday. I have no idea. It just happened. It's over with. Let's move on. And apparently on that long flight home from Seattle, somebody on that plane was had something that got into the filtration system or lack thereof. So that's the reason I was out last night. If you are interested, just a nasty viral upper bronchial thing.
Let's hope that TB patient wasn't there.
No. Different flight. Different flight. Oh, no. No, they had an AirTran flight. We were watching the news this morning. CNN reports that AirTran, which is the airline I pretty much exclusively fly on unless it's out of the country. I really like AirTran. And they said passengers on certain flights were being notified, or a certain flight was being notified by AirTran because one of the people on this particular flight had developed viral meningitis. And I just thought, oh, no. And it turned out it was a flight from this weekend, just past, rather than last weekend. So anyway, that's the reason there was no show to speak of Friday night. And Monday night, we had an encore presentation. Is that what we did? Usually I try to wait till the last minute, hoping for a miracle, like get well. Because like you, I hate to miss work. I really do. But it just didn't happen last night. Coming up here in about half an hour, former Ambassador Joseph Wilson will be on the program with us to talk about the dismissal of his and Valerie Plame's lawsuit against the Bush crime family members. And we've got some Bush sound bites that we didn't get to play Friday due to all those difficulties that we want you to hear. They are from they're from last week, but they are Bush speaking at a town hall meeting in Nashville, Tennessee, and some of them are just a dark humor that we should share with you. What the hell? And then tomorrow night we hope to squeeze in some of Gonzalez's appearance before the Senate Judiciary Committee today. I wonder why the media practically ignored it. You, in order to watch that live, you had to have C-SPAN 3 or go online. And with our satellite system now, we don't have C-SPAN 3. And I spent the day in bed, so I didn't feel like getting online. One thing I was thinking about today, though, all of a sudden, you know, I don't like professional sports. I'm a great football fan, and I used to love baseball. Oh, my God. But I gave it up. I just couldn't take it anymore with all the scandals, all the drugs, the gambling. Just all of it. It just got to a point, you know, when you pay somebody $100 million to play a goddamn baseball game. I mean, excuse me, did I just say the GD word? I'm sorry. When you pay somebody $130 million to play a baseball game or whatever, you know, and I really don't want to get into this, but, look at baseball, football, and basketball right now. You got Barry Bonds, who is about to break Hank Aaron's record, all-time home run record. And he did it the old-fashioned way, did it on drugs. Then you have Michael Vick here, the star quarterback here in Atlanta for the Falcons, who was involved in some really vicious stuff with dogfighting. And to me, dogfighting is just one step above, in a war, putting people, armies against each other. It's just sick. It's so degenerate. And then you have the basketball scandal that's developing, that's going to spread with Tim Donaghy, the referee, gambling, getting in debt to the mob, apparently, and then calling games in a manner. I know all these people are innocent until they're proven guilty. I understand. And if you believe that, I got some swamp land in Florida I'd like to sell you. You know what has happened to professional sports. It's the same thing that's happened to just about every other institution in this country that we all grew up thinking, you know, feeling proud of, happy that it existed, and it's been corrupted. It's been corrupted by money. It's been corrupted by ego. Before I ran into this viral bug, we saw Sicko over the weekend. I don't know if you've seen Michael Moore's movie Sicko. If you haven't seen it, you need to go see it. You have to. It is an astonishingly... a devastatingly intense indictment of what passes for the healthcare system in this country. It's just unbelievable. Unbelievable. Suzanne in L.A. sent me a review of Sicko that comes from Texas, Dallas, from the Dallas area. Yeah, matter of fact, let me share something with you. It's written by Josh Tyler. He says, longtime readers of this site no doubt know that I live in Texas. As everyone knows, there's no more conservative state in the union than Texas. And I don't just live in Texas. I live in the Dallas-Fort Worth metroplex. Dallas isn't some pocket of hippy-dippy behavior. This isn't Austin. Dallas is the sort of place where guys in cowboy hats still drive around in giant SUVs with W stickers on their back windshield, global warming and Iraq be damned. It's probably the only spot left in America where you stand a good chance of getting the crack kicked out of you for bad-mouthing the president. So when I went to see Sicko for a second time this afternoon, I wasn't sure what to expect from the audience. I wasn't watching it downtown, where the city's few elitist liberals congregate and drink expensive lattes. I went to a random mall in the mid-cities, where folks were likely to be just folks. As I sat down, right behind me entered an obligatory cowboy hat wearing redneck in his 50s. He announced his presence by shouting across the theater in a thick Texas drawl to his already seated wife, "Yell me for saying this!" Sicko started. The stereotypical Texas guy sat down behind me and never stopped talking. He talked through the entire movie, and I listened. The first 10 to 20 minutes of the film he spent bad-mouthing Moore to his wife and snorting in disgust whenever Michael Moore went into one of his trademark monologues. But as the movie wore on, his protestations became quieter, less enthusiastic. Somewhere along the way, maybe at the halfway point, right before my ears, Sicko changed this man's mind. By the 45-minute mark, he, along with the rest of the audience, were breaking into spontaneous applause. He stopped poo-pooing the movie and started shouting, "Hell yeah!" at the screen. It was as if the whole world had been flipped upside down. This is Texas, where people support the president and voting Democratic is something only done by the terrorists. Michael Moore should be public enemy number one down here. But by the time the movie was over, public enemy number one had become George Washington, Abe Lincoln, John Kennedy, all rolled together. When the credits rolled, the audience filed out into the bathrooms. At the urinals, my redneck friend couldn't stop talking about the film, and I kept listening. He struck up a conversation with a black guy in his 40s standing next to him, and soon everyone was just peeing and talking about how messed up everything is where it concerns health care. I kept my distance as we all finished and exited at the same time. Outside the restroom, the theater was in chaos. The entire Sicko audience had somehow formed an impromptu town hall meeting in front of the ladies' room. I've never seen anything like this. This is Texas, not France, not some liberal college campus. But here these people were. Complete strangers from every walk of life talking excitedly about the movie. It was as if they simply couldn't go home without doing something drastic about what they'd just seen. My redneck compadre and his new friend found their wives at the center of the group while I lingered in the background waiting for my spouse to emerge. The talk gradually centered around a core of 10 or 12 strangers in a cluster while the rest of us stood around them listening intently to this thing that seemed to be happening out of nowhere. The black guy engaged by my redneck in the restroom shouted for everyone's attention. The conversation stopped instantly as all eyes in this group of 40 people were now on him. He said, "If we just see this and do nothing about it, then what's the point? Something has to change." There was silence. Then the redneck's wife started calling for email addresses. Suddenly everyone was scribbling down everyone else's email, promising to get together and do something, though no one seemed to know quite what. It was as if I'd just stepped into the world's most bizarre protest rally, except instead of hippies, the group was comprised of men and women of every age, skin color, income, and walk of life coming together on something that had shaken them deeply and to the core. In my 30-some years on this earth, I've never seen any movie have this kind of unifying effect on people. It was like I was standing there at the birth of a new political movement. Even after 9/11, there was never a reaction like this, at least not in Texas. If Sicko truly has this sort of power, then Michael Moore has done something beyond amazing. If it can change people, affect people like this, in the conservative hotbed of Texas, then Sicko isn't just a great movie. Seeing it may be one of the most important things that you do all year. And man, I agree with that review, because we sat here and watched it a couple times. Kathy and I both had tears just coming up, streaming down our cheeks from what we were watching. But if you want to really get a sense of what your country has become in this particular realm, healthcare, so-called, see the movie. For God's sake, see the movie.
If this were a movie, is. Too many OBGYNs aren't able to practice their love with women all across this country.
Twice as cloudy as I've been the night before, and I went in seeking clarity.
There is a defining moment in Sicko, and Mike in St. Paul just reminded me of it. There were several for me, but Mike is right. The truly defining moment is when Michael Moore says to off camera, he says, "Can I ask a simple question? Who are we?" And if you haven't been reduced to tears by that point, and are not at that point, well, then you must be a Republican and really don't care about anything. Speaking of things to take a look at, the current issue of The Nation, and you can go online if you don't have a subscription, thenation.com. The attacks on Iraqi civilians, veterans break their silence. This is a lengthy investigative piece by Chris Hedges and... who else? There are a couple writers involved in this, but the main writer is Chris Hedges, the former reporter for the New York Times, I believe. I believe it was the Times. Watch it turn out to be the Post. But you should read this. I read this last night while I was trying to figure out an alternative way to get oxygen into my lungs. But I started reading this because my copy of The Nation came yesterday. And... If you want something that will chill you, this is from American soldiers who are active duty or just recently gotten out of the service. These are not anonymous. They give their names, who they were with, what am I trying to say? They just go completely public. Nothing is held back here. They identify their units. They identify themselves. And it's called Attacks on Iraqi Civilians, Vets Break Silence. Now, coincidentally, tonight on ABC News, there was one of those reports in depth, which means it goes on for all of 3.5 minutes instead of a minute and a half. And it was about the children of U.S. soldiers, men mostly who are being sent overseas for the second or third deployment, and some women, and how American children are dealing with this madness. And I watch this stuff, I read this stuff, and then I listen to this psychopath in the White House, and I listen to these mealy-mouthed, cowardly Democratic candidates for the presidency, and then I see a movie like Michael Moore's Sicko, and I agree with him. You know, the essential question is, let me ask you something: who are we? You know, why are we putting up with this? Also, in the same issue of The Nation, David Goldstein writing about. Food safety. In his last paragraph, his column is called Poison for Profit. And in the last paragraph, he says, in the 6 years since 9/11, foodborne pathogens and toxins have quietly killed 10 times the number of Americans who died in the terrorist attacks. And then he asks this, how many more Americans must conservatism kill before our leaders embrace a more responsible ideology? And that sentence has just kind of stuck with me all weekend. How? Because when you stop and think about every single aspect of the governance or how the society conducts itself or what we do within the society to exist as a society, every single aspect has been corrupted and crapped upon by the conservatives, by the Republicans. Food safety? Nah. They believe in the free market. You know, if enough poison food gets out there, well, we'll just stop buying it from Castleberry or whoever the hell the producer of the poison food happens to be, which is a sick point of view to begin with. That's not how things work. But his sentence, how many more Americans must conservatism kill before our leaders embrace a more responsible ideology? That so applies to Michael Moore's movie. It applies to what's going on in the Middle East. It applies to what's going on in Iraq. It applies to what's going on with all the regulatory agencies in this country. And it is a valid question. And I can't get it out of my mind. How many more Americans must conservatism kill before our leaders embrace a more responsible ideology? David Goldstein is also, blogs on Washington state politics, and he also writes for Huffington Post. And he's a radio talk show host in Seattle. So if you get a chance, pick up the current issue of The Nation and read the article about the attacks on Iraqi civilians by American soldiers. And read it the way it's intended to be read. This is not, you know, a soldier saying, yeah, we're all insane, so we decided to go kill Iraqi children. But it gives you an idea, a first-hand idea, a fresh idea here in 2007 about how this sort of thing occurs and how George W. Bush and his cadre of sick bastards is perpetuating it. About 26 before the hour, I don't think there's anyone in the United States who is politically aware to any degree who doesn't know the name Jill Wilson or the name Valerie Plame. But I wonder how many folks listening to the program tonight know that Jill Wilson was the last U.S. diplomat to meet with Saddam Hussein back in 1991. And Wilson very publicly defied Saddam. Jill Wilson gave refuge to more than 100 U.S. citizens at the U.S. Embassy and in the homes of U.S. diplomats at a time when Saddam Hussein was threatening to execute anyone who harbored foreigners. According to the BBC, Joe Wilson then addressed journalists wearing a hangman's noose instead of a necktie. He told the Washington Post newspaper that the message to Saddam was, quote, if you want to execute me, I'll bring my own blanking rope. Joe Wilson joins us now. May I call you Joe?
Yeah, please do. Sure.
Hey, Joe. Good to have you on the program. I want to start. There's no point rehashing everything that has happened, but I want to start with last week's decision by a federal district judge to dismiss the lawsuit filed by your wife, Valerie Plame, and you against Cheney and other top officials in the what I refer to as the Bush crime family. Where do you and Valerie Plame now stand on that particular issue?
Well, obviously we were disappointed, but we were under no illusions that this was going to be an easy hill to climb. After all, we're taking on the U.S. government in Washington, D.C. But we always understood that either we or the other side would ultimately have to appeal. It just would have been, I think, more satisfying for us if it had been the other side that it had to appeal instead of us.
Mm-hmm.
But we've already filed our intention to appeal.
This judge has stated in his dismissal, I believe, that he was dismissing it on jurisdictional grounds rather than on the merits of the lawsuit. But when you take a look at who Judge John D. Bates really is, it's astonishing. This is a card-carrying member of the Bush crime family. This is a guy who worked for Ken Starr. He is on the FISA court. He's the one who they appointed, I believe, when the former judge resigned in protest of what was going on. So do you feel that there was any prejudice against you and Valerie Plame?
Well, as you correctly point out, you could dismiss it on jurisdictional grounds. We think that there were grounds to appeal. We were pleased that he acknowledged a couple of things in his statement. One, that the acts that these people committed were unsavory, to say the least, and I think that's fair to say. And two, he made the point of noting that that they had asserted that Valerie they had asserted erroneously that Valerie had a role to play in my going off to Niger, which hopefully even for these conservatives will finally put that canard to rest. I take Judge Bates I operate on the assumption that he is a judge, and as a consequence, he has put aside all his political leanings, and his master is the Constitution of the United States. Obviously, we think that that the decision he made was incorrect, but we also understand that the system of justice is such that in the United States is such that you do have the opportunity to appeal those decisions.
I have to say I'm surprised at your statement about Judge Bates, because when he said, and I don't mean to be critical, Joe, because this is your lawsuit, but he said, quote, "The alleged means by which defendants chose to rebut Mr. Wilson's comments and attack his credibility may have been highly unsavory." But then he went on to say there can be no serious dispute that the act of rebutting public criticism, that would be yours, by speaking with members of the press is within the scope of defendant's duties. Is he saying there that the people who revealed your wife's identity had a duty to do so?
Well, I think what he's probably saying is that they had a duty or they had a responsibility to attempt to rebut the assertions I was making. Of course, what's neglected in all of that is the day after my article appeared in the New York Times, the White House acknowledged that the 16 words should never have been the State of the Union address. And within 2 weeks, the Deputy National Security Advisor had offered his resignation, and the National Security Advisor had apologized on a PBS news program because they had gotten it wrong, just as I had asserted. Mm-hmm. What is inappropriate and what we have asserted in our lawsuit to violate Valerie's constitutional rights and her rights to privacy by compromising, betraying, really, mm-hmm. her covert identity, and that is not addressed. And I don't know why that is in Judge Bates' opinion, but certainly that is something we'll be taking up with the appeals court.
So the appeal then would just be to reinstate the lawsuit, not to challenge anything that was said by this judge.
Well, you know, the lawyers are in charge of doing this. They have identified some areas where they think that the decision is worthy of a second look. And they'll take care of all that.
Were you and your wife surprised at the ruling? Did this come out of left field? Was there any anticipation it might come down this way?
Well, we have always said we had full confidence in the system of justice, and we always understood that justice really doesn't like to set precedents or establish new precedents mm-hmm. when it doesn't have to. We happen to think that this is a case where it's worthy of precedent setting if necessary. So we would have obviously liked a different outcome. I will just say this. When the judge does say that the acts that they engaged in were clearly unsavory, mm-hmm. You know, one has to ask oneself, when is the conscience of our justice system shocked enough to permit it to overcome sort of natural concerns about establishing precedent and get on with providing
right.
some relief for people who were the victims of unsavory acts?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and I think it applies regarding so much that the Bush administration has done in the past 7 years. When I told a friend that you were going to be on the program tonight, and the friend wrote, "Could you please ask Mr. Wilson what he thinks America should do in the face of the dilemma we find ourselves in?" And I think the question, Joe, is kind of a broad-based question based on where the Bush administration has taken the whole country. And I'm not just talking about foreign affairs, but also domestic.
Sure.
What do you think America
should
do?
Well, I think we certainly support Congress and its efforts to hold hearings and keep the administration's feet to the fire and not permit the administration to assert these absolute ludicrous privileges. This is a democracy. Power resides as much in the Congress as it does in the executive branch. I also think that it would be very helpful for our democracy if we had more than 48% of the American people voting in any one election.
Mm-hmm.
That gives us essentially 24% of the people of voting age electing who the President of the United States is.
Right.
And so I've always said, and I speak out at universities all the time, and one of my messages that I try and impart to people is this is our democracy. It is our responsibility. It is our responsibility to keep it strong. And you do that only through participation. Congress goes out on recess next week. I think everybody who cares about this country should make it a point of seeking out their representatives in the town meetings or public sessions that they will be having while they're on recess and challenging them on some of the things that that have been going on in Washington. And Arizona, of course, has two Republican senators and a couple of Republican Congress people, one of whom I think is in a little bit of trouble up there in Flagstaff, Pine Top area.
Right.
But certainly, I think they should be challenged on the actions they're taking in the names of the American people. And in particular, all this crap about the troops. American troops, boys and girls, are out there dying in somebody else's civil war. Many of them have been separated from their families for, you know, two out of the last 4 or 3 years. And it is an unconscionable that the party that's in power, the administration, is not really doing everything it can to get them out of harm's way and get them out of the business of fighting somebody else's civil war.
Do you think that Congress, whether it's the House or the Senate, and or the Democratic candidates who are out there debating these issues now, do you think the issues are being addressed in a manner that is positive, in a manner that indicates that the Congress or the Democratic presidential candidates want to end this madness? Or do you think that so far, politically speaking, the Democratic presidential candidates are just kind of chomping along like they usually do?
Oh, no. There is no doubt in my mind that we have a good group of candidates. Now, I've endorsed Hillary Clinton. I think she understands this better than anybody. I think she's got a strategic vision. She will get us out of Iraq. She's a fighter. She could have walked away from this fight after the Clinton administration, but she didn't. She's been fighting for the people of this country for her entire adult life. And I know her well. She's reached out to us with the experience of having gone through the Republican smear and slime machine and has provided us with wonderful advice and counsel, and particularly to me, helped me focus on what is the big picture here. And the big picture is the future of our country. I think we've got good candidates, and I think, by the way, I think Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid and Dick Durbin and the Senate side are doing, and Pat Leahy in particular, are doing terrific jobs in trying to shepherd a very complicated process, and justifiably so. Democracy is messy. But keeping the pressure on the administration on a number of different fronts.
All right, Joe, if you can hold on just a second, we have to do a quick break here. We'll be right back. We're talking with former Ambassador Joe Wilson. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Everybody knows that you live for ever when you've done a little line or two. Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Still picking cotton for your.
Standing up to the flying monkey right, it's more of Mike Malloy.
It's about 10 before the hour. We're talking to former Ambassador Joe Wilson. Excuse me, Joe, I know you have to bail out of here in about 8 minutes. Let me back up a bit. Before the recent events and the lawsuit, I want to go back to a personal note, and I'm sure you've been asked this 100 times, but as a husband and father, I'd like to ask, how shocking was it to discover that your wife's covert CIA status was revealed by members of the Bush administration? You must have been worried about your own safety and your family's safety.
Well, sure. And in the intervening years, we've had a number of threats, credible threats, that have been investigated by the various security organizations of the United States. But what we've worried about most of all, of course, is how this impacts on our ability as a country to get the information we need in order to enable us to combat the bad guys. Who is going to put their life on the line now, stealing secrets to give to the United States, knowing that the President of the United States will not even protect his American agents? How can you feel any sense that you might be protected? Mm-hmm. On the contrary, you might just be thrown under the bridge or under the bus for, you know, sort of crass political reasons by senior officials in the administration. That's exactly what happened. And by the way, I would just add that if, in fact, Scooter Libby had gone to the St. Regis Hotel to meet with the Russian military attaché instead of Judy Miller for the purpose of betraying Valerie's identity, what would we call it?
Right.
Why would you call it any differently, anything different, just because he brokered that betrayal through an American journalist?
That's very true. That's very true. In light of what the your attempts to stop a war, in light of how your attempts were treated, in light of everything this Bush administration has done, what do you think now, and given the fact that its so-called approval rating is really in the tank, what do you think that this administration is going to do to deal with the problems that they've got now? They're backed into a corner. So the question comes up constantly for me, and I think on this program, should we be concerned that this administration will do or allow something to be done that would usher in some sort of a crisis situation behind which they could hide? I think you know what I'm saying, and it's got me concerned.
Well, I'm not sure they would be able to get away with it. They certainly treat the American people and the Constitution of the United States with utter contempt. It's very clear at sort of a less than dramatic level that you're suggesting. It's very clear that the president is embarked in line to the American people yet again. Today he was in Charleston, South Carolina, and he mentioned al-Qaeda in Iraq 95 times in a 30-minute speech. It is the big lie, and it is a campaign of fear. These are the tactics that Karl Rove has perfected over the years, and that's what they're using now to try and rally some semblance of support through scaring the American people for what they're doing to destroy this country.
And you know, not only did he mention al-Qaeda 95 times, but one of the websites, Democratic Underground, did a breakdown. He also mentioned terror or terrorists 40 times in that speech, Osama bin Laden 23 times, attack 22 times. The word strategy was mentioned once, and the word plan was mentioned zero. And using the word strategy, it was Osama bin Laden's strategy, or al-Qaeda's strategy, not that of the United States.
He never uses verbs anyway, I guess.
That's true. What would be, if you were asked, what would be your best advice? What should Americans be doing right now? I understand the obvious, support the democratic process, work like hell to try to get this administration out of power, but I think they have shown that they have the ability, they being the Bush administration, has the ability to totally ignore popular opinion, the pull of the democratic process. They just ignore it or sidestep it. What's your advice?
Well, I'm certainly not going to argue that we sidestep the democratic process. This democracy has held us in good stead for 230 years. It takes time. Americans lack patience. But I think by providing support to Congress, And by confronting Republican members on the views and their continued support for an administration that has betrayed, really, the national interests of this country, is a good way of doing it. They will all be back in their districts for a month. So here in New Mexico, we've got Heather Wilson in Albuquerque. We've got Steve Pierce down in Las Cruces. We got Pete Domenici. I'm telling people, yeah, go out there and talk to them every time. And it's very clear to me, having been in Washington for many years, the Congress comes back from these recesses having had their views changed by their constituents.
Just a very quick answer here, 30 seconds. Do you think that impeachment should be pursued?
Well, I think the committee should continue to do their work. And at some point, the committees that are charged with this, the Oversight Committee and Judiciary Committee, will be able to make a decision as to whether they ought to recommend impeachment charges be brought. We may get there.
Mm-hmm.
We may get there. And in this case, I think that there is a legitimate reason to pursue the possibility of this administration engaged in high crimes and misdemeanors that have put this country at great peril.
So rather than just initiate hearings in the House Judiciary Committee, you're saying allow these investigations to go forward and collect whatever evidence can be collected, let the American public hear what the testimony is, and then make a decision?
Yeah, I've always believed that you allow decisions like this to flow from the facts as you're able to discover them.
Mm-hmm. Any plans now for you and Valerie Plame regarding any further work with the U.S. government in any form?
Well, I've always said that if the president calls you and asks you to do a job, it's hard to say no. I don't lose a lot of sleep over that right now because I'm probably the last person that this president's ever going to be.
No, I'm at the next one.
But again, I mean, if a president of either party, and I've served presidents of both parties, were to call and ask me to do something or ask Valerie to do something. Our commitment to our country is profound. I think we've demonstrated that both in our public service career and over the last 5 or 6 years we've been fighting these sons of bitches on their betrayal of the Constitution of the American people.
I hear you, and I agree. Ambassador Wilson, thanks a lot for taking time to talk with us today.
My pleasure. Look forward to doing it again sometime.
Take care. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, bye. We'll be back after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio. Welcome back. It's about 6:30 past the hour. This is the Malloy program on Nova M Radio. And it is not a best of, or what do we call it now? Encore presentation. We're live tonight. Our North Metro Atlanta military correspondent, Sharon, sent this to me. It's from Common Dreams. And it gets into the fact that in earlier wars, that has seen the deaths of American soldiers. At the Arlington National Cemetery, the names and birth dates of the soldiers were usually, and rank and branch of service was usually all that was listed in the, on the gravestones. But now nearly all Arlington National Cemetery gravestones for troops killed in Iraq or Afghanistan are inscribed with the slogan-like operation names that some freak in the Pentagon or the Bush crime family selected to promote public support for these conflicts. Common Dreams says families of fallen soldiers and Marines are being told they have the option to have the government-furnished headstones engraved with Operation Enduring Freedom or Operation Iraqi Freedom at no extra charge. The vast majority of these stones are, like I said, inscribed with just the basic required information, name, rank, military branch, date of death, and the war and foreign country in which the person served. And families are supposed to have final approval over what goes on the tombstones. But that is not happening. The Bush crime family is such a corrupt, filthy organization. It is now having these headstones inscribed, whether the family requests it or not. Here's one example. The parents of Patrick McCaffrey, who was killed in Iraq in June 2004, said Operation Iraqi Freedom ended up on his government-supplied headstone without family approval. This young soldier's dad said, "I was a little taken aback when I first saw that name on Patrick's tombstone. They certainly didn't ask my wife, they didn't ask me, and they didn't ask Patrick's widow." McCaffrey said, quote, "In one way, I feel like it's taking advantage to a small degree. Patrick did not want to be there. That's a definite fact." Even in death, you can't get away from these evil sons of bitches, even these young soldiers, and the ones that are not so young, can't get away from this filthy Bush-Cheney crime family, even when they've been murdered by Bush's policies. It's astonishing. I don't know. I've said before, there's not a night that goes by that when I'm ready to do this program, some little item or tidbit hasn't popped up somewhere. In mainstream media, in a newspaper, on the internet, somebody's emailed it to me, some item that just blows me completely away. And then tonight, this one. not even allowing the family members to determine what's on the gravestone, if anything. I mean, let me rephrase that. Not allowing the families to reject this sloganeering horse crap that the Bush crime family is so involved in. I don't know. See, I can't get pissed off tonight. I can't. I can't scream because right now I just feel like somebody took an ice pick to my throat. So I've got to be careful tonight. The BBC has a new investigation about the Bush crime family, and they're showing a story about Bush's grandfather planning a fascist coup in America. Now, most of you are aware of this, but it's a BBC Radio 4 investigation. It's not television. Bush's grandfather was involved in a conspiracy, that's Prescott Bush, on behalf of a group of influential power brokers, this is Prescott Bush I'm talking about, to overthrow FDR and implement a fascist dictatorship in the U.S. based around the ideology of Mussolini and Hitler. Now, excuse me. I'm sure you also know that Marine Corps Major General Smedley Butler, we've all heard of Smedley Butler, back in 1933, he was approached by a wealthy and secretive group of industrialists and bankers, including Prescott Bush, who asked him to command a half-million-strong rogue army of veterans that would help stage a coup to topple FDR. According to the BBC, the plotters intended to impose a fascist takeover and adopt the policies of Hitler and Mussolini to beat the Great Depression. It goes on to say the conspirators were operating under the umbrella of a front group called the American Liberty League, which included many families that are still household names today, including Heinz, Colgate, Birdseye, General Motors. Butler played along with the clique to determine who was involved, but later blew the whistle and identified the ringleaders in testimony given to the House Committee on Un-American Activities. However, the committee, since it was neo-Nazi itself, refused to even question any of the individuals named by Butler, and his testimony was omitted from the record, leading to charges that the committee was involved in covering up the matter, and that the majority of the media was behind it, blackballed the story. So, you see, a corrupt government and corrupt media is not something exclusive to our time and place, truth seekers, right? Smedley Butler, of course, was the winner of two Congressional Medals of Honor, I think the only soldier to whom that was ever awarded, two of them. He's the one that made the famous quote, "War is a racket." In 1936, William Dodd, the U.S. ambassador to Germany, wrote a letter to President Roosevelt in which he stated, quote, "A clique of U.S. industrialists is hell-bent to bring a fascist state to supplant our democratic government and is working closely with the fascist regime in Germany and Italy. I've had plenty of opportunity in my post in Berlin to witness how close some of our American ruling families are to the Nazi regime. A prominent executive of one of the largest corporations told me point blank that he would be ready to take definite action to bring fascism into America if President Roosevelt continued his progressive policies. Certain American industrialists had a great deal to do with bringing fascist regimes into being in both Germany and Italy. They extended aid to help fascism occupy the seat of power, and they're helping to keep it there. Propagandists for fascist groups try to dismiss the fascist scare. We should be aware of the symptoms. When industrialists ignore laws designed for social and economic progress, they will seek recourse to a fascist state when the institutions of our government compel them to comply with the provisions." End quote. That's written in 1936 by the U.S. ambassador to Germany in a letter to Franklin Roosevelt. It's just astonishing, isn't it? Huh? Do you think it's astonishing, or are you yawning? Oh, God. And here they are again, 70 years later, 75 years later, here is this little rat bastard grandson of Prescott Bush trying again. Now, we all know that Charles Lindbergh and Henry Ford and some of these people were Nazi sympathizers from the get-go. They wanted fascism in this country as badly as you and I don't want it. But it's a constant struggle. It's a constant struggle, isn't it? to prevent a takeover by these bastards. And that's why I think we are kidding ourselves to think, you and I, and people who believe in freedom and the democratic process, we're absolutely kidding ourselves to think that all we have to do is, you know, call our representatives and say, well, I think you ought to impeach him. You know, the time is coming, don't you think, when it's going to have to be a lot more direct than that? No? Bush was, like Joe Wilson said, Bush was in Charleston today with his usual crap, attacking the critics who say that Al-Qaeda's operation in Iraq is distinct from terrorists who attacked the U.S. on September 11th. He does it over and over and over again, doesn't he? This guy is just, it's just, see, there's an election coming, maybe. Bush needs more support, more bodies, more death, more destruction, more money for his little adventure in the Middle East, and he's out there telling the lies again. I oh, man. All right, calm down. Take a breath, Mike. Quick break, we'll be back, and we're going to take some phone calls when we come back. So stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
He's a liberal with a microphone, and that makes him dangerous. It's More Mike Malloy.
It's 21 past the hour. I guess after the next break, I'm going to play some of these sound bites for you of Bush speaking Thursday at this so-called town hall meeting in Nashville. Aha, town hall meeting my ass, but that's what they call it. Let's do some phone calls right now. Kirk is calling from Worcester, Mass. He's listening on the Internet. Hey, Kirk, welcome to the program.
Yes. Hi, Mike.
Hey.
It was great to hear Joe Wilson. I saw Joe Wilson at Clark University here in Worcester, Mass. A while back. My question was to hopefully if you could get Brad Freeman from BradBlog.com on, or maybe Ralph Neese from People for the American Way. Brad's been talking about this bill, the Holt bill, H.R. 811, that I believe it probably requires a touchscreen voting to have a paper trail, but he wants to go back to paper ballots altogether, which is a much better idea.
Sure.
People from the American Way is advocating, according to Brad Freeman, for more touchscreen voting machines, which, I mean, shocks me. Brad was also talking about this bill that's going through the Senate Resolution 1487 Ballot Integrity Act. I'm hearing it's supposed to give more control elections to the voting machine corporations. I think it's like if you want to challenge an election, I think it's like going through the EAC corporations or something like that. VotersUnite.org has some more details about the bill.
Right.
But it sounds like a very bad bill. And it's being the person that's making this, Feinstein. I mean, I was shocked that a Democrat would make a bill that would kill the chances of the Democrats winning the next election. And I was looking at some of the sponsors.
Well,
Bernie Sanders,
you know,
is sponsoring it.
Right. We've had Brad on several times, and we'll probably have him on again. I think as far as touchscreen voting is concerned, Kirk. See, I don't have any problem with using touchscreen voting. I really don't. Provided it's open source program that runs the vote tabulation, where anyone can where it's very verifiable. It's just open source. So there's no proprietary control. It's not owned by some right-wing business buddy of George W. Bush's, the program. A. B. That the program would be written by and controlled by some sort of nonpartisan Democrat and Republican and some third parties in there, too. Maybe four or five different representatives of various political parties. I'm getting too idealistic. Never mind. To hell with it. Let's just go back to paper ballots. Stephen is calling from Texas, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Stephen. Hey, Stephen. Welcome to the program.
Yeah. Something I've always wanted to ask Ambassador Wilson, I didn't have a chance to, is a lot of people don't know, but he was George Sr.'s, the president, current president's father's ambassador to Iraq
right
before Gulf War I started. And there's all kinds of stories about how there was April Gillespie met with Saddam Hussein and Tariq Aziz and basically, in effect, gave them the nod to say that the U.S. had no interest if they went ahead and into Kuwait. And
well, you're right. We probably should have asked Wilson, but I don't think April Gillespie, who was the acting ambassador to Iraq, actually sat down with these people you just mentioned, Saddam Hussein and the other guy.
Well, she sat down. There were some high-level meetings where she basically said that the U.S. had no interest if or had no
right.
Not act if the U.S. went into Kuwait.
If Iraq,
and it might have been some kind of dream of another trumped up war possibly, and I hear very little talk about that.
Yeah, you're right. I should have I should have brought that up, but April Gillespie, I believe, Stephen, was the acting ambassador after I think the last American representative to talk to Saddam Hussein was Joe Wilson. So,
I think April Gillespie probably worked for Joe Wilson or worked very closely with Joe Wilson. And
well, she worked for
like Joe
she
Wilson
worked,
was
she,
highly
she,
involved
she,
in all this, but no one ever asked him about it.
She worked for the State Department. She didn't work for Joe Wilson.
Joe Wilson worked for the State Department as ambassador to Iraq.
Right. So they both worked for the Secretary of State, but April Gillespie did not work for Joe Wilson. That's all I'm trying to say. Next time we get a chance to talk to him, Stephen, I'll be sure to bring that up. Thanks for checking in. Quick break. We'll be right back. I'm Mike Malloy.
You're listening to Resistance Radio with Mike Malloy.
26 before the hour. Excuse me. Raj over at TV News Lies points out that April Gillespie did meet directly with Saddam Hussein, and you can get a transcript if you want to take a look at it. It was published by the New York Times on Sunday, September 23rd, 1990. In the international section, New York Times, Sunday, September 23rd, 1990. And there's a transcript of this meeting between April Gillespie and Saddam Hussein. And it's in that meeting that Gillespie makes the quote that's been used so often, where she says, where is it? "We have no opinion on the Arab conflicts, like your border disagreement with Kuwait." Now, the lead up to that was a discussion that Saddam was having with April Gillespie about his intentions. The price of oil at the time, I think it was $12 a barrel, and Saddam Hussein was talking about how much that was destroying the Iraqi economy, and April Gillespie said she certainly understood. But if you want to check it out, there's a longer absolute URL here, but you can find it. New York Times, Sunday, September 23rd, 1990. Excerpts from the document on the meeting with the U.S. envoy, April Glaspie. So you can check it out yourself, all right? God, I hate these people. These Bushes, I just hate them so much. Oh, my God. All right. let me get to some of these sound bites from... Last week, last Thursday, when Bush was in Nashville, and Kathy, does it start with number 65? Is that how it starts? 64? Okay, I don't think I've got that one, and it's probably lost. Oh, here it is. All right. Oh, God! All right. Let me set it up for you here. It's a town hall meeting in Nashville, Tennessee. The audience to which was carefully screened, as all audiences that surround George W. Bush are carefully screened, never to let in a terrorist or a Democrat, certainly. Before taking questions from these assembled citizens, you know, these randomly selected citizens from the general population and not pre-screened, in any way, Bush discussed some of the most pressing issues in America today, and they are buns and muffins.
Some of the employees from the Nashville Bun Company are here. Thank you for being here today. It's quite an operation. It's I love going to small businesses. More money in a small business is treasury. The more likely it is they'll be able to expand, and when they expand, the more likely it is they'll be hiring new people.
Uh-huh.
We also put incentives in the tax code that said if you purchase equipment, you're a small business owner and you purchase equipment, like the, you know, English muffin rolling deal or whatever you want to call it.
Rolling deal.
We provide an incentive in the tax code to encourage you to purchase equipment.
Uh-huh.
That only helps your business become more productive and more competitive. It also means that the English muffin... A manufacturing company, English muffin machine manufacturing company, is more likely to have work.
Oh, my God. The logic is just brilliant. It just got the way he connects the dots about English muffin production. Next, Menza Man moved on to the economy, jobs and budgets and stuff. You know, he wants people working on best decisions of their families and doesn't want Congress to raise your money because they won't reckon it to deficit. That's how he talks. That's not how I talk.
People are working. And that's what we want. We want people to say, I'm making a living for my family.
Yeah.
And I've got more money in my pocket so I can make decisions for the best of my family. I now want to talk about the budget.
Okay.
People say, you can't balance the budget if you cut taxes.
Really?
That's one of the arguments in Washington, D.C. I think all of us would like to balance the budget.
Yeah.
But they're saying, we're going to raise your money so we can balance the budget. There's a flaw in that argument.
What argument?
And that is, most of the time they raise taxes on you, they figure out new ways to spend the money as opposed to reckoning it to deficit.
What? Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Yeah, they spend money on things like children's health care. We won't have any of that. One last bakery reference. Yes.
Well, I just want to know, how much is the glorious minimum wage increase that was signed?
It's up to $5.85. I think it went up 50 cents.
Put some food on your family.
One last bakery reference here before Monkey Man moved on to the Q&A portion of this floor show. In this one, he's still rambling on about how the Democrats want to raise taxes so nobody can make buns or something.
I'd like to show you what the Democrats had proposed. Here's their proposal.
Boo.
They've added billions of dollars in new spending on the budget they submitted. The reason I'm not bashing anybody. What I'm here to do is educate you on the different approaches to how we're dealing with your money when it comes to the federal budget.
Uh-huh.
I would warn the Nashville Bun Company to be very careful with this kind of approach because you can't keep making buns if the Democrats take all your dough.
Ah, wait a minute. What? You can't keep making buns if the Democrats take all your dough? Boy, is that a knee slapper, huh? That's a real throat catcher. Jesus, I'm going to have to sit here for 10 minutes and gather my breath.
So here he is. He slips up a bit on his presidential rights and responsibilities where it concerns budgets and appropriations. But, he doesn't know squat anyway. Can't really fault him for not understanding which branch of government has appropriation powers. You can't fault him for that because he's taken so much power with so many executive orders and signing statements, he doesn't know where in the hell the executive branch stands.
I appreciate you letting me come and give you a little budget discussion.
Oh, yeah.
And now I will tell you that there's an interesting relationship between the president and the Congress.
Used to be.
The president has got the right to initiate spending bills, and they do. They got the right to decide how much money is spent.
No.
And I've got the right to accept whether or not the amount of money they spend is the right amount. That's what's called the veto. If they overspend or if they try to raise your taxes, I'm going to veto their bills.
What? The president has got the right to initiate spending bills, and they do. No. No, they don't. Bush has the right to submit a budget that he would like to see entered for discussion in the Congress. But, Mr. Bush, you dumbass, you don't have the... Oh, never mind. What's the point? Next, he took questions from the assembled Nashvillians, like this one on immigration and his guest worker plan. Listen to the exploitation this compassion conservatives plan for Mexican workers. Here's a question from the randomly selected Nashvillian. Mr. President, my question is, in light of the immigration bill, I'm not understanding exactly how, with the amnesty of this many people coming in, and then with the still concern about the borders being somewhat porous, how do we really achieve your desired effect in this, which would be for obviously taking care of them, and yet afford not to be a big bulk sort of expense and the lack of the safety of the border?
I'm real familiar with the border. I was a border state governor. Now, you go to Arizona, for example, you can't find the border. Man, it's just desert. It is like wide open desert.
Really?
And so what you're beginning to see is new infrastructure, new technologies, some fencing. There are people who are coming. Oh, look, let me start over. There are people in our hemisphere whose families are really hungry. They're willing to do jobs Americans don't want to do. That's reality. Some say, well, force Americans to do the jobs they're unwilling to do. Well, that's not the way the system works.
Yet.
And yet there are people willing to come to get in the fields and, the agricultural sector. There are people willing to pick apples in Washington. Get in those vegetable fields in California.
Oh, my God. You notice, though, that the question sounds like it comes from Bush. I mean, the people who allow themselves to be pre-selected for this garbage talk and think just like Bush. I guess you notice that. Do we have to take a break here? All right, we've got one more, but let's wait until we come back so you can get the full thrust of this last one before I reach for the ice pick and jam it in my ear.
I just have to say, I mean, Bush thinks that Americans, there's no American that's willing to pick apples. There are jobs people in America just aren't willing to do, like picking apples. I bet you I could walk out on the street and find 10 people in half an hour who would go pick apples in Washington.
I'll bet you could, too, but...
They just won't do it for a dollar an hour.
You're kind of missing the point, Kathy, and that is Bush is insane.
The sign says there's no vacancy. As you stare at me vacantly, the lights are out, but I can't see. There's nobody home. Oh, no, there's nobody home. I love your smile, but when you talk, there's nobody home. I
you speak your mind.
Nobody home.
It's nice to have some quiet time.
There's nobody home.
The sign says there's no vacancy, but everything you said to me convinces me most certainly.
We're going to keep our promises to the elderly in America. This requires a sense that of urgency.
I would not run from the Holocaust. I would not run from the bomb. I'd welcome the chance.
10 before the hour. All right, last Bush soundbite for tonight. Like I said before I reach for the ice pick. This question is about his bloody carnage and disaster in Iraq. And, of course, Bush constantly wants to mind... almost said the F word. Bush wants to... what's a good word for that? What's a good word for... can you think of one? You know the word I'm thinking about, Kathy.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of a kinder, gentler euphemism, but...
I can't use the F-bomb on this.
I don't think so. No, how about just mess with your head?
Okay, all right. Bush wants to mess with our heads. No, that doesn't quite get it, no. Bush wants to mind blank us all. How's that? That those who attacked us on 9/11 still want to kill us. But, of course, not... the exact same 19 hijackers, because, like, you know, them are dead. Them are dead. Now, this randomly selected and not pre-screened audience member asks the following. Mr. President, I appreciate your position on the war in Iraq. We've got a debate that's going on as much about should we stay or should we come home. Is there any way to change the tenor of the debate to determine how we win in Iraq?
People ask me, are these really Al-Qaeda? Well, they have sworn allegiance to Osama bin Laden. What else are they?
Democrats?
They are cold-blooded killers who have declared publicly that they would like to drive us out of Iraq to develop a safe haven from which to launch further attacks. And it's hard work. And it's tough work. And it's tough work because there are ruthless people... who have declared their intent to attack us again, trying to prevent success. And, you know, I can understand why the American people are tired of this.
Oh, yeah?
Nobody likes war.
Cheney does.
Nobody likes to turn on their TV set and see needless death at the hands of these extremists. But I want to remind our fellow citizens that much of the violence they're seeing on their TV screens in Iraq it perpetuated by the very same people that came and killed 3,000 of our citizens. People sworn. Not the exact same person. Those are dead who got on the airplanes. But they have sworn allegiance to Osama, just like the killers in Iraq have sworn allegiance.
Oh, my God. This man is just so far out of touch with anything, even having the outlines of reality, as to render anything he says just total slobbering garbage in front of these people in Nashville. Well, Mr. President, do you have a plan that would defeat Al-Qaeda and at the same time kill all the Democrats in America?
I'm sorry. I really sat down to get this sound last Friday specifically because I'd heard that one little clip on the AP News, and it just, those are dead that got on the airplanes. I thought, oh, really? Oh, I thought they were out there still trying to attack America.
Well, some of them have been found by the BBC. If not the BBC, the one of the part of the British press several years ago, they found four or five of the hijackers, which just proves that they were not the hijackers, I guess. You know, people who were listed, unless you fall back on that old saw, well... you know, Arabic names all sound the same. But the British mainstream media found four or five of the people that were listed by the U.S. government as among the 19 hijackers, and they found them. And these people say, you know, one was in Egypt, a couple were in Saudi Arabia, I don't know where they were, someplace in the Middle East, and these people were saying, what the hell are you talking about? Here, pinch me. Look, I'm alive. I wasn't on flight whatever. It's just madness. I mean, it really, really is. It is just insanity. And we are all trapped in Bush's madness. The madness of George W. Bush, that's where we all are. It's like being, I don't know, being a fly on a spider web. You know, we just can't move. We can't seem to extricate ourselves. We can't seem to get away from this slovenly bastard. What's his so-called approval rating now? Is it down to 26%? How can 26% of the American people still support this insanity? But it doesn't matter. I mean, none of the percentages matter. It doesn't mean anything. You know, Bush could be down to a negative number. And this psycho would still find, I don't know, he would force, like he did today, some sort of military audience to sit there and listening to him as he goes further and further and further around the bend. We all need to pay attention to this, to listen to what he says. Every chance you get, listen to what this man says, because what we are witnessing up close and personal, and it may be the death of us all, but what we are witnessing is the process by which someone goes insane, a public office holder, someone in a position of power, let's put it that way, how they go mad. You don't have to go to Shakespeare. You don't have to go to any of the Greek playwrights. Just look at this. Listen to him. Watch what he says and how he says it. I should say, listen, he's making me crazy. Listen to what he says and how he says it. Watch his body language and his face. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. If it doesn't kill us all or continue to kill a percentage of us. But to watch someone with this kind of power to do good, totally use it for evil, and in the process, go insane. That's what we're watching. Welcome back, about 7 past the hour. This is an email I got the other day from Susan in Massachusetts. Mike, please take into account that the whole effort and only reason to impeach President Clinton was the Karl Rove plan to diminish and trivialize impeachment, so we would never again be able to bring impeachment to the American people. It worked wonderfully, didn't it? See you at the barricades. Susan in Massachusetts. This is from Bill. Hi, Mike. My guess is Michael Vick has just about aced himself out of a career and probably into a short but symbolic stay in a federal penitentiary. The press is presently having a fine time showing films of dogs mauling each other. everywhere I go, people are talking about what an atrocity it is. Not that he doesn't deserve what's coming to him, but it's ironic that Mr. Bush and his buddies in government can be directly and indirectly responsible for killing at least a million innocent people while suffering nothing. And Vic will do time for killing dogs. I wonder how many people from other countries view this hypocrisy. I wonder how people from other countries view this hypocrisy. This is from Bill. I know. I notice that there are, I don't know, the media makes it appear, television makes it appear, there are hundreds, if not scores, of people on the streets of various cities protesting this, no argument here, horrible story about Michael Vick and his killer dogs and the dogfighting and the how Vick's associates would execute the dogs who didn't win. You know, hanging some of them, for Christ's sake. But the way television presents it, it appears that there's just all sorts of protests going on. And well, there should be. But the comparison my emailer is making here between those atrocities and the atrocities committed by George W. Bush and Dick Cheney are, you know, there is no comparison except when you get to how both stories are treated by media. And I don't know. It's just awful. Like I said, I've given up on professional sports a long time ago. It all sucks, every bit of it. I can't think of anybody in any professional sport who's there because of the game. They're there for some other reason now. I you know, to hell with it. And this, I've been meaning to get to this, not to bring up a topic from a couple of weeks ago. This is an ongoing topic on this program, Israel and the Middle East. But this is from Anne. She writes some complimentary things. I enjoy listening to your program and a few other things that are a little bit embarrassing because they're very complimentary. Thank you, Anne. But then she says, I'm writing about the Israel-Palestinian issue. I am Jewish. I wish you would not characterize the American Jewish community as one entity having the views of AIPAC. There are many American Jews who belong to Peace Now and other progressive organizations that are trying to do something about the horror meted out by Israel and the Palestinians, as well as the response by Palestinians to that horror. All of us are not on the same page who are Jewish. Do not assume that all American Jews are in agreement with AIPAC's point of view that any criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic. I understand your anger about being branded an anti-Semite by those who think any criticism of Israel is equal to anti-Semitism, but please don't be angry at me and others like me. That isn't fair. Also, you said something that sounded like you were saying Israel is composed of only Jews. I know you know that's not the case, but it wasn't clear from what you said. There are many non-Jews and many Arabs who live there. Not everyone does know that. I don't want the general public to assume that the horror done by the Israeli army and leadership is somehow an intrinsic trait of my people any more than others can assume that the horrors committed by our government is a trait of Americans, per se. I realize you know all these things very well, but I hear such raw nerves when you talk about Israel, which I understand, but please don't assume or project that the loudest Republicanist Jews are most... that the loudest Republicans are mostly Jews... Thank you for your humanity and your nerve. Well, in the first place, Anne, I never, if you've heard me say the American Jewish community is one entity, then I don't know where you heard me say that, because I've never said that. I've said to the contrary. I've said exactly the opposite. To say that I've suggested the American Jewish community has the views of AIPAC is another glaring mistake in your email. I've never said that. As a matter of fact, I've gone out of my way to make the distinction. As far as American Jews who belong to Peace Now and other progressive organizations, I understand that and have said that on the program. All of us are not on the same page who are Jewish. I understand that. I've said it repeatedly on the program. Do not assume that all American Jews are in agreement with AIPAC. I've said that many times on the program. I don't understand your email, Ann. And this bit about you said something that sounded like you were saying Israel is composed of only Jews. No, I've never said that. I pointed out that members of the Knesset, there are members of the Knesset who are Arab Muslims. So I don't know what the hell you're talking about, Ann. I really don't. I realize you're trying to say something here. And I appreciate the compliments in the first part of your email. But practically everything you attribute to me on this program is the exact opposite of what I've said. So I don't know how to respond to your email. Except as I just did. All right. Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton the other night in the YouTube debate, they were both asked a question. Obama offered to meet without precondition with leaders of countries such as Cuba, North Korea, Iran. The question came, as all the questions did, from a YouTube a questioner via YouTube. And Obama was asked if he would be willing to meet without precondition in the first year of his presidency with the leaders of Iran, Syria, Venezuela, Cuba, and North Korea. And he responded, I would. And Hillary Clinton has jumped all over that now. She said, I thought his answer was irresponsible and frankly naive. She said she would never meet with, she would never be used for propaganda purposes. And she said such meetings are step-by-step process. It's not just some event. Madeleine Albright said that. But what is astonishing to me is that, in the first place, Barack Obama qualified his answer by prefacing his answer. He said, you don't, Jesus, I don't have it in front of me. I'm sorry. Clinton said, you don't refuse to talk to bad people. She said this in February, so she's pretty much said the same thing. She said, you don't refuse to talk to bad people. I think life is filled with uncomfortable situations where you have to deal with people you might not like. I'm sort of an expert on that. I've consistently urged the president to talk to Iran and talk to Syria. I think it's a sign of strength, not weakness. So, The attempt by Hillary Clinton to kind of shred what Barack Obama said, I thought Barack Obama's answer, I didn't see it live, I've seen it now in clips all over television, I thought Barack Obama's answer was pretty straightforward. Would you meet with him in the first year? Yeah, why not? Jesus, these are not new deals. How long has Castro been the leader of Cuba? 45 years? 50 years? As far as Chavez is concerned, why doesn't somebody just sit down and talk? This is not new stuff. As far as this maniac in North Korea, why not? Why not just show up with a whole bunch of dancing seals or whatever the hell he likes? I mean, he's a weirdo. Just figure out what he likes. Bring him Hershey bars with ribbons around them. I don't know. Pom-poms, firecrackers, whatever this little mealy-mouthed bastard would like. Is that such a big deal? Oh, my God. As far as Syria is concerned, what's the matter with the Syrian president, Bashir Rabat? Oh, hell, I don't have it in front of me, and I'm too sick to just pull it out of the back of my head. The leader of Iran? Who? Ahmadinejad? He's a twerp. All you do is say, come over here. Sit down. Let's talk. Oh, my God. So I just think the way it's being spun by Hillary's camp is nonsense.
I'm thrilled to be here in the breadbasket of America because it gives me a chance to remind our fellow citizens that we have an advantage here in America. We can feed ourselves.
21 past the hour. Anyway, the statement by Barack Obama, he was asked by a questioner via YouTube if he would be willing to meet without precondition in the first year of his presidency with the leaders of Iran, Syria, Venezuela, Cuba, and North Korea. And he responded, quote, I would, end quote. And then Hillary Clinton said she would not. She said, quote, I don't want to be used for propaganda purposes, end quote. And she said she would first use envoys to test the waters. I don't like that. I don't like what happened, because I think Barack Obama answered straightforward and truthfully. Would you meet with him? Yeah. In these so-called debates, Barack Obama, as well as Hillary Clinton, as well as the rest of them, understand that they have, what, 30 seconds, 45 seconds a minute to get the answer out? He was asked simply, would you meet with them? He said yes. He wasn't asked, would you meet with them after a series of meetings by diplomats and so on and so forth, setting up a summit, would you meet then? He was just asked, would you meet with them? And he said yes. And the fact that Hillary jumps all over that, to me, is it's kind of cheesy, but I don't know why I brought it up. I guess because this is where Joe Wilson and I part company, I guess. I just, I don't think Hillary Clinton would make a good president. Oh, I know, somebody's going to say, well, that's because she's a woman, Mike, and you're prejudiced against women or something. No, it's because I don't think she'd make a good president. What else do we got here? I think phone calls. I think I better do this before you all say to hell with it and go home. Let's go to Paula, who's calling from Bayonne, New Jersey, listening on the Internet. Hey, Paula, welcome to the program.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
Doing fine. How are you?
I'm doing okay. I'm just hanging out listening with my friends on the DU Truth Seeker thread.
Really? Is that what you're doing?
Yes.
Well, good for you. Good.
There's a whole group of us that show up every night. We love you.
Well, thank you very much. That's very kind.
Anyway, what I wanted to, you know, there was something that Ambassador Wilson said that made me want to throw something. And that was when he discussed all the pressure that Democrats are putting on the administration. What pressure?
Yeah, well, yeah.
What pressure? I mean, where are they? They're not even using the tools that they have at their disposal.
I know.
To deal with them, Mike. You know, it's like the equivalent of sending a serial killer to bed without supper.
Right.
And it's driving me up a wall.
I know. It but, you know, I had Joe Wilson on just to talk about, you know, his situation, and I didn't want to get into it.
Oh, I understand that.
You
I
know. You know
it's
what
not
I mean,
appropriate
yeah.
to pile on the guy and,
right,
you know,
right.
can disagree. But I just, it's just, I'm just...
No, when he said it, I felt the same response that you felt. And yet, towards the end of our conversation, he did seem to qualify it a little bit, and he left me with the impression that if impeachment proceedings were started against these two thugs that run the country now, Joe Wilson would certainly be in agreement with that. That's the impression I got.
Well, that's good. I would just wish more people. I mean, have you heard them? Democratic congressmen and senators who are on, you know, the Sunday shows when they talk about it. It's downright Republican, the unison it's the exact same talking points that they use. I've never seen them as unified on anything.
I know. And to me, it's out of cowardice. They're afraid that the American public will punish them in November of 2008 and not vote for them. And I maintain that if the Democrats don't do something soon, then the American public will punish them in 2008 by not voting for them. You understand what I mean?
I feel the same way. And the thing, you know, what I think is possible is down the line, Bush is going to become so toxic that the Republicans will start the impeachment stuff.
Well, they can't. They might cut a deal with the head of the House Judiciary Committee. Who is that? John Conyers? I'm not sure who. I guess it's Conyers.
Yeah, John Conyers. But I think they'll start the. I think they will start the. You know,
well, no, they
talking
can't.
About it. And...
Well, they can talk about it, but they can't start anything. It's up to the party in power. But I'm sure that if three or four Republicans on the House Judiciary Committee went public and said it's time to remove this bastard from office, I'm sure that the Democrats would fall in line and agree.
Yeah, they would, and then who would get the credit for it? Republicans!
Right.
And then, you know what I mean? It's like, Duh.
I know. You know, you may have just hit on a strategy. The NSA listens to our program. I wouldn't be surprised if Karl Rove gets transcripts. So, you know, you may have hit on something here that the Republicans... Pay attention over the next couple of weeks. If Republicans come out in favor of impeachment, they took your idea, okay?
Well, Carl, if Carl's listening, better send me some money for it. I don't work for free.
All right. Thanks, Paula. You take care. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy.
Justice and the American way. It's more of Mike Malloy.
Twenty-six before the hour. Back to your phone calls. Mike is calling from Chicago, listening on XM satellite radio. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program.
Hello, Mike.
Yes.
Oh, it's an honor to talk to you, sir. I just got you back on XM, and man, did I miss you. I got to say that. I'm a Republican, okay? But if every Democrat in the world was like you, Mike, I'd be a Democrat.
I'm not sure what you mean.
Well, I want to tell you, after 9/11, I think the only reason I didn't go stark raving mad was because of you and listening to your show. I used to look forward to every word that you said. I couldn't believe some of the things that you said on the radio. And I knew that you were telling the truth to America, and I consider you to be a truth seeker like I am myself. Right? You know,
well,
I
what do you consider Republicans to be?
Well, with the conservative viewpoint, Mike, the only reason I consider myself to be is I'm against the war. Okay? And I was from day one.
Yeah.
Okay? But I got guns. Okay? And so, I'm anti-abortion.
So what?
Okay.
Well, wait. I've got guns. I'm anti-abortion. So what?
Well, I mean,
let me just take a little, one step further. I don't understand the gun part. Unless what you're saying is the Republicans or the conservatives have tried to teach you and brainwash you into believing that Democrats want to get rid of guns. The only president who has ever ordered the confiscation of guns in this country in modern times has been George W. Bush, and that was in New Orleans when they sent Blackwater in to take away people's guns. And wait a minute, let me finish, Mike. This is very important. Very important. Anti-guns is and always has been Republicans. Now, as far as being anti-abortion, every single person that I know who is pro-choice, so-called pro, I hate that term, but let's use it for a minute because that's what everyone uses. My friends here in Georgia who are members of NARAL, the National Abortion Rights League, who are members of the Georgia chapter of that, these are people who support the idea of a woman having the privacy to make her own decision. These people are anti-abortion too. We're all anti-abortion. But that's not what the issue's about. Roe v. Wade is not about abortion, Mike. It's about privacy. It's about, does a woman have a right to make a decision about her own body with the help of her doctor, the man who may have been instrumental in getting her pregnant, and her concept of right and wrong? That's her business. It's not mine. It's not yours. If you had to make a decision about some critical area in your life, I don't think you would want the government telling you what you could and couldn't do and invading your privacy. So, Mike, you have to understand something, and I'm not saying that in a patronizing way. I really mean this. Liberals have always, I mean, we've always owned guns. You know what we're against? We're against people having firearms that can be used on a battlefield. We're against unregistered, unrestricted gun ownership. My guns are registered with the DeKalb County Sheriff's Department. I have no problem with that. I don't have a problem with it at all. And as far as being anti-abortion, everybody is anti-abortion. The people who really work to bring down abortions are not the Republicans and the right-wingers. It's the Democrats. It's the ones who talk about sex education. It's the ones who talk about explaining to our children when they reach puberty about if you're going to have sex, use a condom. Those are the people who are anti-abortion. Did you know that the 8 years of Bill Clinton, whom a lot of people consider to be a liberal, but he wasn't, abortion in this country fell precipitously, and it's gone back up under Bush? So I just wanted to make those points, Mike. I'm not trying to override you here.
I agree with you, Mike, and I know that.
But you know, Giuliani favors the right of a woman to make a choice regarding her own body. Giuliani favors gun registration. Giuliani is in favor of the right of gay folk to have civil unions if they want to.
Giuliani is centra, and that gets me to my point. I don't believe that we've got Democrats and Republicans anymore in this country, Mike. I think that it's a shell game. I think that it's a tag team. And I think that whoever's got the money, okay, now I think that foreign interest is getting behind these presidential candidates that we have running for office right now. And I'm sure that's where people like Barack Obama is getting $30 million, not from the American people, but probably from some foreign interest group.
Oh, Mike,
I don't trust any of them.
Mike, hold on. Do you know what campaign disclosure forms are?
Yes, and I
okay.
Heard
do you do you, hold on? Hold on. Do you understand that political candidates have to file these campaign disclosure forms? I don't know, every 30 days, every 90 days, whatever the hell it is. Do you understand that every dime collected by, since you brought him up, Barack Obama, is verifiable on the campaign disclosure reports that you can have access to? Come on, Mike. Don't sit back and say that Barack Obama or Mitt Romney, I don't care who it is, that they're getting money from foreign sources. Come on.
I believe they are.
Mike, you might believe that monkeys fly. That doesn't mean they do. I'm just saying, if you believe monkeys flew, you'd go to the zoo and you'd look at a monkey and you'd look for wings and you'd see, by damn, they don't have any. They must not be able to fly. All I'm saying to you, if you think these candidates are getting money from foreign sources, take a look at their campaign disclosure forms.
Well, it's my opinion that they are, Mike. But let me say this. Two more things. Two more things, Mike. I think you should take some therapy.
Sorry, Mike. I just kind of lost it there. I'm not feeling well, so you'll have to forgive me. Chuck is calling from Tennessee, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Chuck, welcome to the program.
Hi, Mike. How are you doing tonight?
I'm all right.
You going to make it?
I'm all right. I really am, Chuck.
I wanted to talk to you about Bush a little bit, about... you know, they're saying that there are some that are saying that when the Republicans come back from the break, there's going to be a group of them that's going to approach Bush and say, look, we just can't support this anymore. You're going to have to pull out of Iraq. And when that happens, there's a very good chance that he may start ticking over dominoes and letting these presidential directives kick in and put us in a situation of... basically, a march on Washington, or just bow over and let him do what he wants. A very dangerous situation.
Do you really think that Republican it was Republican senators that went to Nixon. Do you, and it's been Republican senators for the most part who, like Chuck Hagel, like Olympia Snow, like I can't think all their names now. Do you really think? And this is just a question, not a challenge. Do you really think that? Did we lose Chuck? What happened to Chuck's call? I guess it just disappeared. Chuck, I'm sorry. If obviously you're still listening, you're listening on Sirius. We lost your phone call. If you call back in, Chuck, we'll take your call again. But it's not all that necessary. Are you there, Chuck?
I am now.
Oh, there you are.
There for a second.
Okay.
I'm not quite sure what you said, but at any rate.
Well, let me ask you again. Do you really think that Republican senators are going to approach Bush and Rove and Cheney, the gruesome threesome, and say to them, "Hey, it's time for this to stop"? Now, what do you mean? Just stop the war or get the hell out of the presidency?
No, stop the war.
Stop the war. Okay.
I don't think he's going to do it. I don't care what it takes. I don't think he's going to do it. Short of being either assassinated or taken out of office, because I think every day he sits there, he makes another $1 million. And I think he's motivated by greed. I think he has been from day one, and I think we have a very serious problem with that in this country. We've got an entire group of people who are basically trying to turn this into a fascist state, which is no news. I mean,
right.
Everybody's been saying this, okay? My thing is this. When the dust settles, let's assume that we have a presidential election. And let's assume we get someone in there who has a chance of being honest. It's going to take a hell of a lot to straighten out this country. I mean, we're talking about job protection. We're talking about throwing companies out of this country that don't provide jobs for Americans if they want to sell American products.
No, the list is endless of the damage that's been done.
It really is, but it goes beyond just what everybody's been saying, in my opinion. I mean, we're going to have a situation where anybody who makes over $3 million a year, for example, not only pays 70% with no tax loopholes, but their whole financial structure is based on e-transfers.
Yeah,
do away with cash altogether.
I hear you. Chuck, I got to leave it there, pal. We're coming right up on a break here. Thanks, Chuck. I appreciate what you had to say. Ten before the hour, thanks to the crew, Ian Huff, who engineered the program in Phoenix at our flagship station, KPHX. He also answered your calls. Our senior correspondent, Chris in Minnesota. Our moderators at MikeMalloy.com on the message board. And, of course, the executive producer of this program, Catherine Bay. Oh, Billy Foster. I almost forgot Billy Foster. I can't forget Billy Foster, who is Nova M Radio's CIO and moderates everything inside the Nova M Radio chat room, which you can participate in every night if you want to. NovaMradio.com. Click on chat. I guess you have to be a founding member, but that's cool. You could do that too. And thanks to Walgreens Drugs here in the Atlanta area for providing me with nasal spray to get through tonight. And thanks to the makers of Natural Vitamin C. Oh, never mind. Jeez. All right, back to your phone calls. Jake is calling from Arcata, California, listening on KGOE. Hey, Jake, welcome to the program.
Hey, Mike, how's it going?
It's going.
I'd like to know why there isn't a investigation of that Republican senator from Louisiana, David Vitter.
Oh, yeah.
You know, let's remember that Bill Clinton was impeached for his liaison with Monica Lewinsky. And here we have the Republican senator, David Vitter, the so-called champion of family values, you know, the guy who ran on protecting marriage from gays and lesbians. What about David Vitter's marriage? I mean, this is a guy who was frequenting prostitutes, did all sorts of weird stuff. Apparently, Vitter was into wearing diapers. I don't know what was going on there. But, you know, Larry Flint apparently had all the goods on Vitter. So why is Vitter still in the Senate? Why don't Republicans, you know, go ahead and ask him to resign?
Well, asking I guess the House leadership could ask him to resign. The House Republican leadership, his constituents back in his home district could start a recall movement, but he can't be impeached. He's just a representative from a district. There are 435 representatives, and they're not important enough to impeach. The other thing is, Vitter is just a lying, hypocritical, typical Republican conservative. He didn't lie under oath. Bill Clinton was led into a perjury trap, and arguably, in the deposition... in the Paula Jones case, made a statement that the Republicans jumped on and said amounted to perjury. Whether it did or not, there's arguments on both sides of that issue, but it was enough to get articles of impeachment introduced against him. So there's a big difference. Vitter is just a hypocrite. Bill Clinton was just a skirt chaser who got caught. I don't think Clinton ever came across as a pious religious right nutball like these guys keep on the right keep doing and keep getting caught because of their hypocrisy. So I guess that's the answer, Jake.
Well, you know, remember George W. Bush when he was running for president in 1999, he said on this televangelist program there in Texas that God told him to run for president.
Right, God told him to invade countries. And, you know, if you talk to God, that's called praying. If God talks to you, that's called schizophrenia.
Yeah, and in George W. Bush's case, it's definitely schizophrenia, Mike.
I hear you, Jake. Thanks for checking in, pal. Virginia is calling from Alameda, California, listening on the Internet. Hey, Virginia.
How you doing, honey? It's been a long time. You sound so stuffy.
Yeah, I am stuffy. I've got a sore throat, and I'm ready to puncture my eyes. I feel so bad.
A sore throat, that primal scream. Boy, yep. I had to put you on speaker. That was painful.
That was painful, yeah.
But you deserved it. I hope it hurt him even worse than me. Anyway, honey, thank you for standing up for Obama on that pseudo-argument of Hillary's. That woman is out of her mind. I've just lost it with her.
It's crazy. You know, it's one thing. I realize she figures she's in a death match to win the Democratic Party
mm-hmm.
nomination. But for heaven's sake, you know, why? You know, Hillary should know, and I think she does know, that this corrupt, doggish kind of media that we have in this country will pick up on a comment like that and turn it into a fight between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama just for the sheer sport of it. That's what media do in this country. They're corrupt and they're evil. But Hillary should have just kept her mouth shut. Let the man say what he wants to say. When it comes her turn, she can say what she wants to say.
But know why she had to make a big point of it, Mike? Because what that guy that made you scream said about Obama is true about her. And she does have, you know, she gets millions from AIPAC and USIPAC and who knows who's back. And,
yeah,
you know, she has to... When she did agree with what Obama said before, uh-huh. and she even said it in the Foreign Policy Institute and I don't know where else, and stuff, a bunch of places, and stuff, I think they got down on her. And they told her, look, we're giving you all this money, and we don't need you cutting deals with these people. You know, you got to uh-huh. cut deals with us. And Obama doesn't get money from any of those people, so they want it to be made an issue of. And she, you know, the press didn't make an issue of this. She did. It was insane. It's like he put that comment that he's inexperienced and you know, I mean, that's just, they all this is backfiring them. You know what I found in like the fourth to last paragraph on page 2 of a poll report yesterday?
Wow.
That Obama now has 46% of the black vote and now she has 40. Now it was headlines when it was vice versa, right? But now, this is what's happening. So the woman is just losing her mind. But everything that she does just fires right back on her. With that Laura Flanders comment that she did on Lou Dobbs. What is she doing on Lou Dobbs anyway?
I know. It's
where, you know, Hillary's got balls and Obama don't. Like, you know, he got castrated. And then this nonsense that he's immature and inexperienced and naive.
Yeah.
You know, that just irks people. And it's all...
Hello? Where'd Virginia go? Did we lose Virginia? All right. We're out of time anyway. Virginia, I'm sorry. We lost the connection.
One thing I wanted to say about Hillary, I did see a good portion of the YouTube debate while you were so ill, and I also watched Sicko, and I realized how she absolutely shut up about health care, universal health care reform, after she started accepting a bunch of money from
the pharmaceutical industry.
Sure, and the big health care insurance companies. And I noticed in the debates yesterday, she really skirted around the issue, whereas Edwards and Obama, they all came out very strongly about universal health care. She was very weak.
That's very true. I'll see you tomorrow night, Truth Seekers, I think, unless I'm in an oxygen tent. Take care, all right? Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio.